This is the second in a series of interviews with Father Malachi Martin. It is being recorded in his home in New York. Father, in this discussion, we're going to take a look at the situation from the perspective of the average layman in the pew. He's starting to realize that in many cases, in virtually all cases, in fact, something is going wrong in the world, something is going wrong in the church. And we'll start right with his home and his family. And many parents are finding it very, very difficult to raise their children because there's all these influences on them that seem to be anti-Christian. Could you maybe comment on the difficulties that a family has in raising its children, and what are the sources of these difficulties?
Yes, it's worth talking about that, Bernard, because the mass of Catholics are lay men and lay women with children and jobs and homes, and they live in certain areas, and they have to cope with the situation in their areas. And the universal experience in the West, forgetting for the moment the East in the sense of the former Soviet Empire or the Far East, but talking about the West, that is North America, South America, and Western Europe and Australia and New Zealand. It's the same story everywhere from all the magazines and books that come out. It's quite obvious that nowadays it is extremely difficult, if not impossible, extremely difficult, requiring heroic virtue, to rear your children and to yourself and your wife, or yourself and your husband, to behave in a way which formerly was regarded as normally Catholic. What has happened, and why is it so difficult? And is it going to change? And are you simply out of step? Should you be in step with the general march and stop worrying about things? Look, there are a few things we must comment on, first of all. The essence of Catholicism. You see, in my life, I have found non-Catholics, Greeks, Russians, Syrians, Protestants of all kinds, very pious and good. I mean, sometimes they were saints in my estimation. But missing was one Catholic ingredient, one typically Catholic ingredient. And if you don't find this ingredient, you haven't got Catholicism. It's this. If you examine the entire sweep of Catholic theology and pastoral care over the centuries, down to the middle of this century, you'll find that Catholicism meant many things. It's a rich storehouse, by the way, which we're neglecting nowadays. But it's a rich storehouse, but one note always came out. There is a thing called Catholic intimacy with the divine. What does it consist of? Oh, listen, apparently very simple things. It's prayer to the Blessed Virgin. It's devotion to the angels. It's novenas. It's the Blessed Sacrament being visited for 5 minutes to say hello, to console our Lord, to talk to him, to ask him about the problem of that mortgage, to talk about that child who's playing truant, to talk about your difficulties with your wife or your husband. Then it's benediction. It's the repetition of hymns. It's the constant flow of thoughts and devotions and recommendations from the Pope through the bishops to the people, and from the people through the bishops to the Pope, and pilgrimages. And it is this network of intimacy with all things belonging to heaven, because Catholicism set out to establish on earth a replica of what heaven is, so that you could have the food of angels every day, and you can assist at the supreme sacrifice of Jesus, and you can embrace his wounds every day in Holy Communion, and you can talk to Our Lady and get her help, and your boys can grow in the image of Christ, and your girls can grow in the image of Our Lady. And then there would be special people set aside, devoted to him, like priests and nuns and religious orders. And then there would be the occasional special event, like a pilgrimage or a special mission. But it all centered on this uniquely Catholic trait of intimacy with the divine. We were allowed to have our conversation with heaven. As St. Paul says, our conversation is with heaven on this earth. Now, what normal people have found is that suddenly that is cut off. Suddenly they are expected to dialogue with each other. Suddenly they're expected to regard the priest as somebody the same as them. Suddenly they're supposed to treat Jesus in the Blessed Sacrament as something very separate from their lives. Suddenly they're supposed to engage in sociological and in environmental studies instead of studying anything about their faith. Suddenly they find that the rosary is no longer prominent and is not sold even in churches. Suddenly, in other words, everything is taken out from under them. They find their children coming home from school saying that, well, the Buddhists are very good. They're just as good as us, only they have different faith. Then they find the bishops writing on purely sociological and anthropological questions and political questions. No longer have their stream of devotion and teaching about the life of Jesus, about hell, about heaven, about sin, about purgatory, about the truths of our faith. All this has suddenly gone. It's been cut off. That's the basic obstacle they find today. The result is that they find that what they thought was Catholicism is no longer Catholicism. They find that at Mass, they're not supposed to spend time in thanksgiving. They're supposed to sing hymns, which no longer are Catholic hymns. Sometimes they're hymns to nature. Sometimes they're poems about men and women. Sometimes they're quotations from Buddhism or Hindu books. And then they find that at Mass itself, there's no longer the devotion centralized on the altar. It is centralized on somebody dressed in leotards doing a dance. Or it's centralized in peculiar banners and in new forms of expression, even drawn from natural, say, events like storms and seas. They no longer have a spiritual vocabulary. Everything has changed suddenly. What did happen? What produced this? Well, if you see ever an overall phenomenon affecting millions of people, and there are millions of people in the two Americas and in Europe, and it is all stamped in one way and comes at you suddenly, comes at them all, you can be sure that it didn't happen by chance. In other words, we know now that this has been a concerted plan being put in action by an organized body of men. The difficulty is that since it is so universal, we know that it started at the top. It didn't start in one diocese. It didn't start in one country. It started in Rome. Because the church is so arranged that the pipeline from Rome flows into all dioceses. And we can track now through the various pontifical organizations and through the communications in those pontifical organizations, we can track the instructions and the directives given so that overall in the church, in the West, in Europe, in the Americas, in Australia, New Zealand, this message would go out loud and clear. This is the way you do it. This is how you conform. And it's a terrible situation because it has affected people in Rome. For instance, John Paul II did issue an indult called Ecclesia Dei, which says that we must, after all, take care of the sensibilities of people who want the old way of doing things. And therefore, we must have some measures that will take care of their wishes. Cardinal Meyer, who's in charge of this, recently has made it quite clear that this means that he will restore the Mass in certain places and he won't restore it in other places. And when asked about it, he said, well, that's the meaning of the indult, that the bishops can do what they like. And this is a twisted view of what the Ecclesia Dei indult originally meant. It means that Cardinal Meyer is no longer free. It means that in Rome there is this super force that they cannot dislodge at their peril. And that therefore that has a hold of the teaching church. Recently, when the Pope appointed conservative bishops in Europe, 173 theologians signed a document, Germans and Belgians and French, saying the Pope had overstepped his authority. And nobody has said they haven't been condemned. In 1984, when John Paul II wanted to make the Tridentine Mass, if you want to call it that, a rite on equal parity with the Novus Ordo, four cardinals flew to Rome, Basil Hume of Westminster, who is no longer Catholic in my estimation, that's my own personal opinion, Cardinal Lustiger of Paris, and two more flew to Rome and browbeat him into saying, you cannot sign this document. He didn't sign the document.
There seems to be a network which frustrates people like Cardinal Meyer, who are, let's say, trying to implement traditional forms of Catholicism.
That's right. There is a network which frustrates them. And the fact that they cannot do anything about it means it's powerful, means it has all the levers of power in its hand. And therefore, that this is one of the reasons why John Paul II knows all renewal is impossible. He cannot do anything about it. He had to excommunicate Archbishop Lefebvre instead of going himself to Ecône and performing the ordinations, which was his original wish. He couldn't do that. He wouldn't be able to get back to Rome, probably. Because here's the essence of that organization, Bernard, and it's frightening. There is a large body of highly placed clergy, beginning with cardinals and going down as low as Monsignore and then into priests, who have one aim in life, and that is to make sure that any exercise of Petrine authority obsolesces and falls into desuetude. And de facto, they have brought church administration to the point that the Pope no longer exercises papal authority, except in a rare case when it's useful to them, the excommunication of Lefebvre. But otherwise, he doesn't exercise it. You see, there are two ways of my getting rid of you. You are with me in the company, and you have a job. And I don't like you. I want to eliminate Bernard Jansen. Well, I can try and get you killed. I can try and get your job suppressed and you fired. Or I can arrange it so that your job becomes otios, becomes pointless. You shuffle papers. You have no influence on company policy. You have nothing to do with the sales of our goods. You have nothing to do with the financial aggrandizement of the company. You sit in your office. You are useless. You have obsolesced. You're in desuetude. Your job is a sinecure. It means nothing. That is the aim of the present superforce, to make sure that the Petrine exercise of those keys ceases, and therefore that it will be more or less like the ostrich feather fans they used to wave around the Pope when he was on the sedia gestatoria being carried in public. They're just relics of the past. Oh yes, we used to do that, but we don't do it any longer.
In other words, their goal is to make the Pope somewhat like the Queen of England, just a symbol.
Yes, but the ultimate aim is destroy Petrine authority. Destroy the unity of the church around Peter. And that's the destruction of the Roman church. That's the aim. And if you examine carefully the behavior of a thing like the Bernardine machine, as we call it in the United States, it's Cardinal Bernardine of Chicago who runs the bishops, the USCC and the NCCP, you'll find that it's always an endeavor to say, well, we Americans think this, we can't adopt the Roman point of view. And the French do the same, and the Spaniards are doing the same, and the Germans and the Belgians, and the Latin Americans are trying, some of them are trying to do the same thing. It's an effort to make sure the Pope does not exercise authority, because once he ceases to exercise it for an amount of time, it obsolesces. He doesn't do that. He has overstepped his authority, as the 173 signers of the Cologne Declaration said. You have no right to do this. You're Bishop of Rome. You administer that. Leave us alone. We can manage our own church in Germany, our own church in America, the Americanist church. That's the aim of it.
Let's take a look at what happened after the appointment of this East German bishop. Later, after there was that protest, the next bishop to be appointed was Caspar to the Diocese of Stuttgart.
Walter Caspar. And Walter Caspar has written several books. He's a prominent theologian. He's been in the Synod, the Roman Synod, several times. And from his books, it is extremely clear that Walter Caspar no longer holds with the Magi coming to see Jesus, no longer holds with the Ascension. In fact, several truths of the faith that we've always believed that belong to Catholic intimacy with the divine no longer hold for Walter Caspar. Why make him a bishop? Well, I suppose you could ask the same question of Bishop Lehmann, who in his book seems to lean in favor of the fact that St. Joseph was the natural father of Jesus. How can these men become bishops? Because the superpower is in charge. How does that work? It works like this. If you think, or if anybody thinks, the Pope decides to make Bernard Jansen Bishop of Strasbourg and writes a letter to Bernard saying, you are now Bishop of Strasbourg, come and be all consecrated by me, then you have another thing coming you. That is to pass through the bureaucracy-sodden and laden mechanisms of the Vatican, which is peopled with the superforce. all with their instructions, all with their anti-papal mentality, all with their point of view, ready to scotch things, ready to guide things, to push things at the bottom of the pile, to refuse an appointment, to make it impossible to do it, bureaucratically. He cannot just sign a document. There are 5 or 6 signatures that go with it.
Do you think that in the church, a lot of the power has passed from the hierarchy and into the bureaucracy, into the committees, into the chancery offices?
On the local level, yes. The bishop, the moment anything happens in a diocese nowadays, he sets up a committee. The committee makes its decisions for him. The bishops meeting in Washington at their annual meeting, they're handed the results of bureaucrats, the hidden little powers working in hidden offices whose names never appear. They give the bishop their decisions. Most bishops are extremely ignorant of theology and sociology and politics. They just sign the documents because the rest of them are doing it. Nobody's going to rock the boat. On the diocesan level, that's true. In the Church Universal, it's in Rome. The choke points are and the blocks are. And there, John Paul II wouldn't live long enough to weed it out. He has no power to do that. It is just too strong. And I would think, too, that any really manly attempt to eviscerate the superforce in the Vatican would be met by his death.
Do you think that's what happened in the case of John Paul I?
It is a feasible supposition. But I have to cling to history in this matter. We don't know. And I also feel in the Catholic Church, once a pope is dead, that's that. It would be nice to know. It's titillating the imagination. It's horrific for the imagination to find out the truth about these things. But the pope is dead. Long live the pope. We now have another pope. And what happened to John Paul I is hidden in the bosom of God. We'll find out in eternity, or we may find out even in time. There have been attempts to say one thing or say the other. Nobody can establish it as of yet. And I wouldn't try and establish it. I'd be afraid for my own kneecaps.
Let's go back now to these committees and the chancery offices that make up these religious programs.
And like new rules.
New rules, let's say, with granting of annulments. Are they thinking of the laity at all? Or are they chasing some illusion? Or what are they? Because
no.
The laity have never asked for this stuff.
These are no longer Catholics in the Roman Catholic sense. They have another religion. Bernard, you and I have to admit and face the fact that there is a thing called neo-Catholicism, which lacks any instinct for Catholic intimacy with the divine, which repudiates all Roman control by the Roman Pope, which doesn't see the Pope as the universal bishop of the Church. It sees the Church as a collection of believers who are now engaged in marching with their fellow man towards the utopia that's going to be brought about by the New World Order. They belong to that. And they don't think they share all the views of man's liberty to pick his sexual lifestyle. They share all the views of modern man about changing his partner like a shirt that's worn. They share all the views of man about whether it's killer whales or the snail darter or the environment or euthanasia. They share all those views. They say we must modernize, become part of men, because we're building a new world, a new world order.
So they're chasing an illusion.
Of course they're chasing an illusion.
Let's look again at this new world order.
Mm.
Could you say a bit about this?
Well, the new world order depends on two things which are paramount today, which nobody can escape from. Number one, there's no such thing as an independent nation today. Gorbachev found that out. We're all interdependent. In what sense? We must trade. If you don't trade today, you're dead. Or you're reduced to the status of the pygmies in the Kalahari Desert. There's interdependence, number one. Secondly, there's this. Every nation wants development. What is development today? Development is hospitals, roads, supermarkets, VCRs, all the electronic paraphernalia of communications. It is freedom to travel. It is freedom to choose your marriage, to break it and make another one. It choose your sexual lifestyle. That is development. And it means that you submit to the requirements and the rules of technology, according to technology, develop better way to have better people, hygienically, socially, physically, sexually, medically. That is the idea of development today. That's development. Now, those two forces, mainly being pushed by the entrepreneur, the banker, the transnationalist corporation man, are purely natural. They're materialistic. They're as bad as Marxism, only much more subtle. Because they don't kill you. They swaddle you in pleasant things. And they make sure that you needn't have a deformed child. And they make sure that you needn't live with a partner that finally has grown cold for you. And they make sure that you need never think. Just look at the boob tube. And they make sure that your idea of goodness is reduced to the common denominator of behaving in such a way that you smell nice and that you eat well and that you don't kill your neighbor. And that's the reduction to the absurd of the human ideal within a universe where finally your money and your flag and your sexuality and your food and your reading material and your entertainment is all determined by corporate masses of people. That's development.
And how has this New World Order affected the education system?
It has completely infiltrated the educational system. The education system in the States, in the United States, I'm sure in Canada the same thing, is now a system of secularizing the mind of the people. It no longer takes past history and past philosophy and past religion and translates them into language of today. It is totally new. And hence we find that young people coming out of school today don't know anything before their birthday. They know nothing about it. They don't want to. They're so fascinated by the new world rising in front of them, the electronically geared world, the world of instant satisfaction, the world of new curious developments, of extraordinary sounds and sights in outer space and within the world. Education has been reduced to that, and things that mattered humanistically, like poetry and drama and literature, all that is by the way, is a relic of the past, is in books. We don't read books anymore. Reading is not our forte. We listen and we look, and somebody else decides what we're listening to and what we're looking at. And the result is education, if it's any good, is technological. You're a good engineer, you're a good surgeon. But the spirit, the soul, is gone out of it all.
And that is a very scary thing to think about.
It is a very scary thing because it has affected medicine, it's affected social life, it's affected family life. It means that if I'm going to be Catholic, if I'm going to have my children living in Catholic intimacy, where am I going to suck it from? Because we are no longer surrounded by Catholic institutions that breed that speak about that develop that mirror that. We now have Catholic institutions in every parish, in every diocese, which mirror the new desire for the new world order based on this development of the whole man and on my being successful, my being beautiful, my being happy, my being clean, my being hygienic. This now is the great difference.
Well, it seems to me that the parochial schools, both in the United States and Canada, seem to be just extensions of this new world order.
They have been effective. There's no such thing as a Catholic school in the normal sense of the word now. By exception, yes, you find the odd one. But it's very odd. And that's why many people are turning to homeschooling and why they want alternative, the voucher system where they can put their children anywhere and not pay for the public schools too. Also, which are sinks of iniquity as regards Catholicism in the rearing of children. But that's the difficulty, that they no longer have the Catholic institutions. They have been infiltrated. And whether it's the bishop or the parish priest, or the priests, or the nuns, there no longer is that Catholic intimacy. There is no longer the Catholic separateness. The idea is to do away with all divisiveness. Don't be fanatic about this. Be one of us. Be modern.
So it's trying to meld the church into the one world order.
That's right. That's right. And the difficulty is that it can't succeed. It can't succeed. It can go a certain distance. It can destroy and has destroyed a lot of the Catholic structure. It has produced this grand illusion of the Catholic institution existing when it no longer exists. But it can't succeed because it's materialistic and it's just as bad as Marxism in its own way. And Our Lady has said this is going down the hill. This is going to produce catastrophes in which whole nations will disappear, whole sections of continents will disappear until she comes. And by the grace of God, and by her intercession, and by the indulgence of her Son, saves what is left. It can't succeed. That is the difficulty. And that's a very frightening thought, Brother.
And the families, they don't seem to find this Catholic intimacy either in the parishes. Because you go to, let's say, visit the Blessed Sacrament, now you're going to run into all kinds of problems. Yeah, the church door will probably be locked, and if it's open, the Blessed Sacrament is
not
pushed
there.
Off to the side.
It's not there, or it's not there at all. It's either in the sacristy or something else. And then you look at the church, there's no inspiration in it. Statues are disappearing, and the Stations of the Cross. Who does the Stations of the Cross nowadays? I mean, what an extraordinary idea to go around 14 times and stand in front of pictures and genuflect and pray. It's not done any longer. That intimacy with our Lord's sufferings, with his wounds and his hands and his feet and his side and his head and face, hey, nobody thinks about that. It's not nice. It's not nice any longer. It's not human. It's not humanistic. It's not beautiful.
And you walk into any modern church, and the crucifix, if it's there, is usually the resurrected crucifix. They don't want to portray any suffering at all.
Suffering is out, because that's barbarous and that's primitive, and it's no longer beautiful. It's no longer, it disturbs. Why should I be disturbed because somebody is suffering? Why should I see blood coming from a waxen hand on the cross, or look at eyes that are tortured, or the head pierced with thorns? That's uncomfortable. It's not a nice thought to have, and it's bloody minded. It's primitive. This is the modern point of view. And that's why the confessional is the same thing. I mean, if you go to confession nowadays in many churches, if you find confession regularly, which is very difficult, you find that it's a chat between you and the priest. Sometimes he'll walk you in the garden and talk to you about it. It's a friendly chat between people. Originally, it was you went to a priest to be absolved from your sins. Nowadays, the belief is the priest doesn't do any absolution. You're sorry for your sins, and he agrees with you and gives you a blessing.
It seems to be a psychological thing.
Yeah, it's a psychological thing. It's therapy. It's therapy. That's why confessions have dropped off. Confessions? Who goes to confession nowadays? About in the States, about 15 to 22%, they tell me. In Austria, it's 5%. In Belgium, it's 2%. In Spain, it's 11%. In England, it's, they say, about 3%. Confession is gone. Because sin is gone. I really am not sinful, and the devil isn't. There's no such thing as the devil. I have tendencies which I can correct by going to a shrink, a therapist, or some of them I must let loose. I must have a little give. I must express myself one way or the other. And that's quite lawful, provided I don't hurt anybody. If it's a victimless crime, it's a victimless action. And who cares what I do with Mary Jones down the street, or she with John Bull up the street? It doesn't hurt anybody, and God loves them all. They're all his children. So this idea of sin soiling the soul it's a primitive idea, and no longer coheres with what we know now about the soul, which we only know from shrinks, by the way.
I talked to a modern liturgist not too long ago, and he said that basically we're growing up now, and we're producing a new world. That's his line, and I'm sure it's the line of the modern church.
Oh, yes, it is. It is the modern line of the church. And it's the modern line of churchmen. They find that they no longer need preached sermons. When did you hear a sermon about the Pope's infallibility last? Or about the Petrine power? Or about Thou art Peter upon this rock? It isn't not mentioned. If a priest talks about that, everybody says, well, what's happening to him? What is he talking about? It's no longer the theme of Catholicism. Or Our Lady's purity. Who's going to preach about Our Lady's purity?
I find that those kind of priests tend to get pushed out into the boondocks.
Oh, they disappear. In some dioceses, they're told to leave. They're told to go be gone on Monday, or else we'll call the police. This is happening in several of your dioceses in Canada, and priests are simply gone. They have no support. They leave with a suitcase, and that is that. That's the situation. Again, we go back to the basic thing. This can only happen, Bernard, if faith has been withdrawn. Faith has been withdrawn. And therefore, if you meet somebody who does that, all you can say is, they know not what they do any longer, as Christ said on the cross. They no longer see. They're not deliberately saying, well, this is against the faith, I'm going to do this. No, they don't believe any longer. They don't believe any longer. Which brings up a big question as to what Jesus, the King of the universe, and the head of the church, and the man from whom the Pope derives his authority, what is he planning? What is happening? Why is it like that? Why must it be like that? Is there misfeasance and malfeasance in high places, even with the present Pope or other popes? What has happened that is like that? That's the big question that's torturing people. And how then do I get out of it? I, every week of my life, I have to talk with a father or a mother or both who say, what are we to do about this? We can't get mad. Or we haven't got the proper school for our children. They now don't believe in baptism.
How are we supposed to put all these tendencies into perspective? What is really going on here?
Well, I'll tell you about it. There's a way of considering that question. It's this. I don't know how many people I've heard say in the last 5 or 10 years to me, where is God? Where is Christ? Is he not supposed to be watching over the church? Why doesn't he? Surely God is going to do something now. They usually said this to me apropos of some action of a bishop or a priest. We had finally had our 10th pederastic priest caught by the police, or we finally had some new statement by a bishop or a cardinal, which went dead against what we were taught in school. And they say, well, why doesn't God step in? Surely he's going to appear in the heavens, or the Pope is going to do something. Why doesn't somebody do something? God or the Pope or Jesus or the angels? And you know, when his enemies captured Jesus, late at night, they probably held him from 9 p.m. until 6 p.m. the following day, when he slumped over and died with a loud cry, and Joseph of Arimathea came with the authorization to shift the body. During that time, I'm sure Our Lady didn't say it, I'm sure John the Evangelist didn't say it, perhaps Mary Magdalene didn't say it, but you may be sure that the 500 disciples gathered into Jerusalem and all the apostles went around saying, well, he's going to suddenly wise up. God is going to intervene. He's going to send an army of angels to save him. He's going to do something. But you know, Bernard, he did nothing. It was to go inexorably through to entombment before a resurrection. Similarly with us. There isn't going to be an action of God. There's going to be no intervention of Christ. There's going to be no sudden change where everything will be hunky-dory, finally back Catholic as it was. But it will never be as it was. The church will never be restored as it was. That is dead and gone. We're going to entombment before we get to resurrection. You know, here's the problem. Take yourself back to First Friday, the Good Friday. And the word has come to Our Lady and the women with her and St. John that he's been condemned to die. And they're taking him out to Calvary. Everybody knew where Calvary was. Everybody knew it. Just as we know where Arlington is here in the States. Or you know someplace in Canada, a well-known death place. So they rushed out of the house to try and see him. They hadn't seen him for about 2 days. The last time they saw him was in Bethania with Lazarus and Mary and Martha, where he used to lie with them at night, cuddling them and holding them and being consoled. Because at that time, just prior to his passion, he was being attacked in the streets of Jerusalem, and he was under great pressure. So they rushed to the streets, and they found a vantage point, finally, in the Via Dolorosa, where they could see the procession coming. Roman soldiers, the people, the priests, and this figure under the crossbeam. He was only carrying a crossbeam. The upright was always permanently on Calvary to receive the crossbeam in a socket. Now, Our Lady, she had borne this body. She had seen him from the first moment he was born. She knew every line in that body. She knew all his features. And she had lived with him for all those years under his public life. She knew nothing about him. Yet when she saw that face coming around the corner, first of all, clad in this awful robe they put on him in mockery, with a crown of thorns on him, the pallor of death on him, sweating, his face torn, his nose broken, with one black eye we know from the shroud, and with all the blood he had lost. If you've ever seen a person dying in those conditions, I've seen them once, they're unrecognizable. You don't know them. She took time to notice her Jesus. She took a moment to say, is that he? Yes, it must be him. From some trait, some gesture, some look in his eye, something as he passed her. Similarly, us with the church. We cannot recognize the Catholic Church today. It is so torn to pieces, so lacerated, so beaten up, so bloodied, so dehumanized or de-divinized. We have to have faith, the faith she had, saying, yes, that is our Jesus. And then she went to Calvary to watch him die. We still have to see this thing die completely, entombment, and to see the jeers of it all. That's what we're facing. And that's what Jesus wills, apparently, to allow. And that's what we're facing into today, entombment, gradual entombment of the Catholic ideal everywhere, in public life and private life.
And could it be that those of us who are still practicing the Catholic faith are simply going to have to carry our cross.
That's right, until we die. And that's all that's required of us. The what do you think Our Lady had to carry for all those years in faith? The same thing. She had what we had. She had him. We have him sacramentally. She had the mysteries, the Annunciation, and the Visitation, and the Presentation, and the finding in the temple, and all the other mysteries we haven't been told about. That's all she had. And then the mysteries of his miracles in the public life. And then finally, his death. And until he appeared to her, I'm sure she was the first one he came to offer his resurrection. And that scene is something I can't talk about. It's so emotional. But until that moment, she had no assurance beyond her faith. Yet she never wavered. She never wavered. So similarly with us, we may have to die as we are. And another generation find out what Christ's plans with the present world are. But we have only one thing to do, and that is faith and the Rosary and the Blessed Sacrament and Mass. We needn't bother about anything else. We haven't got the grace to do anything about it. He has not put us in a position to do anything about it. And all we do is live in our faith and die in our faith and don't compromise. That's all we can do. Because now the thing is cosmic. Now the thing is geopolitical. Now it's out of everybody's hands. Because from all the evidence we have, apparently Lucifer is in his last legs. He's going to extremes because he knows the end is near of this period. These Catholic times are coming to an end, and they'll be over soon, within this decade, the present Pope believes. And Satan will be totally rejected and lose the kingdom he has carved out for himself in the Catholic Church and in the world of man. And there'll be a complete changeover. How many of us will see it? I don't know. Do I want to see it? I'm indifferent. What I have to do has to be done every day. Carry my cross after him daily, as he said. That's all that's necessary. I can't bother about this huge struggle because it's beyond my powers. It's cosmic. It's geopolitical. It involves huge superpowers. It involves all the nations of the world. It involves the coming of Our Lady. And you know, one word about Our Lady. There's a scene in the early days of Lourdes. When it became known that Bernadette was talking to the lady, Notre Dame, the local peasants, she was a peasant, used to gather behind her when she was talking to the lady standing in the grotto. They couldn't see it. They could hear her talking. And one day, while they were all there, and she was talking to Our Lady, and Our Lady was talking about the Immaculate Conception, and Our Lady was smiling, apparently. Suddenly, in one of the other caves, the place that had little grottos and caves, a growling as a wild animal started. And the people heard it. It was a very strange growling, a rumbling, threatening growl, as if wild animals were inside and were about to come out and rend them limb from limb. And Bernadette later said that all Our Lady did, she didn't say a word, all Our Lady did was move her head and look at the cave, and it all stopped like that. That's power. That's power. And she can stop all this suddenly by her will, invested with the power of God. But she must do it. And when she'll do it, we don't know. She has said she will do it. But until then, this stream of filth and corruption and decadence in the church, the institutional organization, is going to go on unabated, and you and I can't stop it, except by prayer. And prayer for individuals, clergy and laity, prayer for this cause or that cause. We can't stop the onrush of this drama, because it is a drama. It is Satan in the final throes of his struggle against Jesus. He's had his liberty. And he's done damage, and he's gained millions of souls. They're falling like leaves into hell, Our Lady told Lucia. Leaves, cardinals, bishops, priests, lay people, men and women and children. But she will end it all, she said, because he has granted that power to my Immaculate Heart.
And of course, that is part of the message of Fatima, that she will end it all.
That is the message of it all. But we don't know when, we don't know how, and we needn't bother. That's not our job. That's not our job. It's too big for us all. Pity, therefore, the man in Rome, John Paul II, caught in the engrenage, the mechanism of the superforce inhabiting his Vatican, faced with the total revolt of his bishops and the falling away of whole nations in faith, having to sit down with a Mikhail Sergeyevich Gorbachev, knowing that Gorbachev himself is caught in the net of God's providence, and knowing that
Perhaps he'll return to the faith he had when he was a boy of 10, singing old Slavonic hymns beside his mummy before Holy Communion in the parish church of Privolnaya in southern Russia. Perhaps he won't. Perhaps he'll go to hell with the rest of them who have opposed God. And knowing that he's only a puppet, that God can break into at any given moment once he's done the work God wants him to do in the recreation of man's devotion to God. Pity him, though, his judgment, the weight, the burden on him. And no wonder from being a fresh-faced, almost leopard-like walking man, walking like a panther, he now is worn, stark-faced. He walks slowly. He's carrying a burden, a deep burden. And he has to sit down opposite a pagan like that, who has his little cunning Leninist plots, and who's smiling and smiling like a villain, as Shakespeare says. And he must pray for him, and must shake hands with him and his wife, and try in some way to leave some drop of grace in him from his words and from the action of Jesus. And still he must know that he himself carries the burden of waiting for Mary for the right time and the right place. Pity this man. Pity him. He needs prayers. He needs consolation. He needs support. He needs prayer above all.
I think that's what all of us must do is pray, because all of us, I'm sure, have a burden that we must carry, especially families.
Yeah, families have. Families, they're now the points of support, because we no longer, for instance, in my young days, when you had a problem, you went to the parish priest or the curate, the assistant you knew, or if you could, the bishop, you could go to the bishop with a problem. Nowadays, the last person you'll go to is the local priest, or the local bishop, or the local assistant. You won't go near them, because you'll find that they, first of all, they're in charge of the plant. It's a 9-to-5 job. They have no sympathy with you if you're going to talk about the intimacy of Catholics with the Trinity or with Our Lady. They'll regard you with a slight smile. They might indulge it because you're not offensive. You want some help. But they'll give you some book which is written in new language and about themes that, and they'll ask you to come to a meeting and share the joy of being with the others. And they may, on an odd case, be very enthusiastic for some place like Medjugorje in Yugoslavia, a new apparition of Our Lady.
Let's talk a bit about this apparition. Do you think it's real?
Personally, on a personal plane, I concluded Medjugorje is a satanic hoax.
And why do you say that?
I say that because of three main reasons. First of all, if I examine those apparitions, appearances, I prefer the word appearances, of Our Lady, say Lourdes, La Salette, Guadalupe in Mexico, Our Lady of Revelations in Tre Fontane in Rome, which is the latest one, Fatima, Garabandal in Spain in 1961-62. I find one note always there. The participants, as they call them, the seers, always submitted to the church. And went sometimes through years of silence, persecution, sometimes imprisonment, certainly badgering and interrogation, waiting for church approval, which finally came. Medjugorje is totally different. Total revolt. No, no, we're talking to Our Lady every day. She says this. She told us to say this. We're going to say this. The local bishop has been shunted aside by the Medjugorje people. I think it's now 13 million people have gone to Medjugorje on pilgrimage. And there are confessions and rosaries and pilgrimages and processions every day over there. A huge amount of tourist money has gone into Yugoslavia. The Marxist authorities at that time were very, very enthusiastic about Medjugorje because it increased tourism. But apart from that question of the material benefits, there's that one sign. It was not submissive to the authority. You see, if the authority is even unjust, you have to submit to it if it has the authority. Christ said that. Upon the chair of Moses, the scribes and Pharisees have said, do what they do, but don't do as they say. Don't do as they do, but do as they say. They have the authority. And that's the first sign for me that Medjugorje is not for me, certainly. I can't touch it. Number two, it's what Our Lady is quoted as saying, that other faiths are just as good as ours. Leave the Muslims alone. There are a lot of Muslims in Yugoslavia. Their faith's just, for them it's good. It's not for you. I can't imagine Our Lady saying that. I just can't imagine Our Lady saying that. And there are a whole list of things like that. plus funny incidents. For instance, once during a documented incident, once during the supposed apparition when the children were talking to Our Lady, a French newsman with typical French insolence, the children's eyes are always fixed on this invisible object, Our Lady. He pointed his finger to the eye of one of the children, and the children looked back at him. Now, if the seer was totally absorbed, how could it be like that? So the priest, Vanek, who was there, gathered the child in his arms and went off into the sacristy for a moment. He came back and said, well, the child actually thought the child Jesus was falling from the arms of Our Lady, and he was shocked. So it's obviously a sham. Then there are other things connected with the fact that Our Lady used to appear in the fields, first of all, and then they got it transferred to inside the sacristy, or a little room opposite the sacristy in the parish church. There are whole behaviorisms there. And then the subsequent history of Vanek and other people connected with it that do not smell of heaven. So then there is the alchemy touch. You know, the medieval alchemists used to promise that by the power of the devil, they could change lead into gold. And there's this funny thing of your rosary beads turning from ordinary metal into gold. We had that in Nacidas, in Wisconsin, too.
We had it in Bayside.
Yeah, we have it in Bayside, too, today. So it's alchemy, it's medieval alchemy, an old trick of the devil's. And then there are things like that that are very funny. There's one other factor which is going to make you laugh, but which, for me, is paramount because I'm Irish. The Irish say, the devil can cloak every part of him, make himself the most beautiful angel of light, except his feet. He can't hide the hooves. Nobody has ever described Our Lady's feet in any way. Everything else but her feet. Bernadette said there are roses on her instep. And Garibaldi, same thing. Conchita has described Our Lady's feet. Garibaldi at Mayagori, no mention of the feet. And I'm sufficiently Irish still to say, the hooves. He can't hide the hooves. He always appears with hooves. This is the Irish idea of the devil. As a goat. As an unclean goat. But it's only a sign. It's not the determinant factor in my decision about Mayagori. Now, if tomorrow the Pope says Mayagori is fine, there have been abuses, then I will submit. But, you know, unless Peter speaks and has spoken for Garibaldi, it has spoken for Lourdes, spoken for La Salette, spoken for Fatima, it has not spoken and refuses to speak and is very critical of Mayagori. And therefore, I as a Catholic cannot go along with it at all. Until Peter does speak one way or the other, I hang fire. My impression personally is that it is a hoax.
There have been a proliferation of many apparitions or so-called apparitions in the last 10 or 20 years. And
260 today.
That's incredible. And some of the better known ones are Nisida or Bayside or the Pebble in Australia.
Japan, Africa, they're all over the place. One common trait of a lot of these so-called or claimed apparitions is this. They seem to be imitations of Fatima. Like Mayagori. As if to steal away. My own theory or feeling is that they're supposed to diminish the interest in Fatima, which is the central revelation of this century, private revelation. And they all seem to be imitations of that, one way or the other. They promise the same things, and Our Lady speaking about the same things, and tell destruction, say the rosary, and come and visit me here now. In other words, take away from the dire message of Fatima, which is still running. The writ of Fatima still runs. In Ireland alone, the amount of virgins, statues of the Virgin that have started crying, there's a book written about it I have in my library. And I suspect hoaxes everywhere because the devil is so clever. He's so intelligent. And he's introduced great confusion about this. So we have Mayagori, we have Akita, we have the Pebble, and we have the Bayside. This is all nonsense, the conclusion is. It's all illusions. That's the general idea. The only other apparition appears about Lady, which seems to be grips my soul, is the one in the Ukraine. That is something which is special. There's no doubt about that. But the Holy See has not been able to penetrate into the Ukraine to examine the fact. And the bishops have been in hiding, so there's no question of finding out if it's true or false. But the proliferation, I think, is typically satanic. It's like when we were invading England, when we were invading France, in D-Day, we dropped, I think, thousands of little rubber paratroopers in parachutes And the Germans spent a lot of ammunition, a lot of time rounding them up. They call them Gummisoldaten.
It's a diversion.
That's right, it's a diversion. Diverting people from the Fatima itself, which has a very dire and exact Catholic message, full of devotion to the papacy, full of devotion to the passion, full of devotion to purity and to honesty and to Catholic virtues, and is full of the Catholic intimacy. There's no intimacy in Meyugori at all. It's a different thing completely. So that's my judgment on Meyugori. That's what I think about Meyugori, and why, until Peter speaks, I cannot share any enthusiasm for it. I'm afraid of it. Besides then, it's alchemy, it's medieval alchemy, an old trick of the devils. And then there are things like that that are very funny. There's one other factor which is going to make you laugh, but which, for me, is paramount, because I'm Irish. The Irish say, the devil can cloak every part of him, make himself the most beautiful angel of light, except his feet. He can't hide the hooves. Nobody has ever described Our Lady's feet in Meyugori. Everything else but her feet. Bernadette said there are roses on her instep. And Garibaldi, the same thing. Conchita has described Our Lady's feet. Garibaldi at Meyugori, no mention of the feet. And I'm sufficiently Irish still to say, the hooves. He can't hide the hooves. He always appears with hooves. This is the Irish idea of the devil. As a goat. As an unclean goat. But it's only a sign. It's not the determinant factor in my decision about Meyugori. Now, if tomorrow the Pope says Meyugori is fine, there have been abuses, then I will submit. But, you know, unless Peter speaks and has spoken for Garibaldi, it has spoken for Lourdes, spoken for La Salette, spoken for Fatima, it has not spoken and refuses to speak and is very critical of Meyugori, and therefore I as a Catholic cannot go along with it at all. Until Peter does speak one way or the other, I hang fire. My impression personally is that it is a hoax.
There have been a proliferation of many apparitions or so-called apparitions in the last 10 or 20 years. And
260 today.
That's incredible. And some of the better known ones are Nisida or Bayside or the Pebble in Australia.
Japan, Africa, they're all over the place. One common trait of a lot of these so-called or claimed apparitions is this. They seem to be imitations of Fatima, like Meyugori, as if to steal away. My own theory or feeling is that they're supposed to diminish the interest in Fatima, which is the central revelation of this century, private revelation. And they all seem to be imitations of that, one way or the other. They promise the same things, and Our Lady speaking about the same things, and tell destruction, say the rosary, and come and visit me here now. In other words, take away from the dire message of Fatima, which is still running. The writ of Fatima still runs. In Ireland alone, the amount of Virgin statues of the Virgin have started crying. There's a book written about it I have in my library. And I suspect hoaxes everywhere, because the devil is so clever. He's so intelligent. And he's introduced great confusion about this. So we have Meyugori, we have the Akita, we have the Pebble, and we have the Bayside. This is all nonsense, the conclusion is. It's all illusions. That's the general idea. The only other apparition appears about Lady, which seems to be grips my soul, is the one in the Ukraine. That is something which is special. There's no doubt about that. But the Holy See has not been able to penetrate into the Ukraine to examine the fact. And the bishops have been in hiding, so there's no question of finding out if it's true or false. But the proliferation, I think, is typically satanic. It's like when we were invading England, when we were invading France, in D-Day, we dropped, I think, thousands of little rubber paratroopers in parachutes. And the Germans spent a lot of ammunition, a lot of time rounding them up. They call them Gummisoldaten.
It's a diversion.
That's right, it's a diversion. Diverting people from the Fatima itself, which has a very dire and exact Catholic message, full of devotion to the papacy, full of devotion to the passion, full of devotion to purity and to honesty and to Catholic virtues, and is full of the Catholic intimacy. There's no intimacy in Meyugori at all. It's a different thing completely. So that's my judgment on Meyugori. That's what I think about Meyugori, and why, until Peter speaks, I cannot share any enthusiasm for it. I'm afraid of it. Besides then...
And isn't it symbol, the new Mass?
Oh, the new Mass is. The new Mass is the I think, is the fountainhead of all our difficulties. And it's a calamity because it was our friend Monsignore Annibale Bonini who drew up that mass deliberately in order to create a non-Catholic ceremony. And the difficulty with the new mass is that it has given rise to invalid masses, and therefore the lack of the Blessed Sacrament. And it has also removed people's minds from the central point of the Mass, the sacrifice of Calvary. It now is a meal. It's a communal meal. And it's at a table. And the priest is the minister. But we, the people, are the people who have the meal together. And this is all based on a Protestant, non-Catholic idea of what the Mass is. You see, people come to me because they find out I'm saying the normal Roman Mass, and they say, could I go to your Mass, please? I say, well, let's sit down and have a little talk. And we have a talk, and I find out, now I ask them, what is the Mass? And they tell me usually that it's the Last Supper, that's the meal, commemorative meal. And I say, no, I'm sorry, that we haven't got a meal at all. Some of them do, they'll hit the nail on the head, they say, it's the sacrifice of Calvary. And I say, then what you mean in general is that it's an action. Something takes place on the altar. They say, yes. And then I say, all right, you've been going to the new order, the Novus Order for so long, give me 2 or 3 weeks and come to instruction twice a week for an hour. And I will teach you what takes place as mirrored in my actions as priest. When you can interpret my actions symbolically, symbolizing the action taking place on the altar, then I'll admit you to my Mass. And it's great. They learn the Mass thoroughly. They learn that every gesture has a meaning focused on Calvary, on the cross. And they suddenly say, but this is great. This is something I never taught. And they never knew it. They were never taught it. These are young people. They weren't born back in the time I was born. They suddenly realize that going to church is not a question of singing hymns and saying hello to the pastor and being greeted and then be giving bread and wine to drink and feel happy about it, shaking hands with others, embracing them, and having breakfast afterwards, which is a continuation of the sacred meal. But it's a question of assisting at the action of Christ dying and living forever.
Could it be then that what they've done to the Mass is symbolic of what they've done in the whole church, and that is to try to remove those sacrificial aspects from Catholicism,
right.
The cross from Catholicism,
right.
Make it something easy and nice and palatable to the world.
That's right, that's right, that's right. It's exactly it. I couldn't put it better myself. That's what they have effectively done. And that is, you can ask yourself then the funny thing, that the moment a priest proposes to say the Roman Mass in a diocese, oh, this horror. I mean, just get out of here. The priest is told to go, or they get at him and say, this is impossible, you can't do this. The Holy Father doesn't want this. The church doesn't do this any longer. This is old hat. We now have the Novus Ordo. You do this or either or. There's a horror of the Mass. An absolute horror. And disgust. Disgust. I remember reading a very prominent French theologian, a Jesuit, quite recently, who said that by chance he had to assist at one of the Roman Masses in Paris. He said he found it disgusting. The idea of a man turning his back on the populace and praying quietly. Such a disgusting idea. And I know that Jesuit has lost his faith. He no longer knows what goes on. He doesn't know what's going on. And that's the destruction of the center of Catholicism. Because believe you me, without the Mass, and without Holy Communion, without that Mass, Catholicism dies. That's why the Irish, for 400 years, used to have rock masses. They had a rock behind which the priest here and the people gather there and they said Mass. Keep the Mass going. Now that it's died out, now that we have invalid masses, and we have many invalid masses, because many priests are not validly ordained, and many bishops don't ordain validly, no wonder grace is lacking. You get sanctifying grace through the sacraments, mainly the Blessed Eucharist and Holy Communion. So that's the plight of the Church, and the effort has been to destroy that.